Chapter 8 Caring for the Dying. To the yogi, death is the sauce that adds spice to life. B.K.S. Iyengar. The Needs of the Dying by Christine Longacre. After years of listening to many people who are dying, hearing them try to articulate what they need during this most difficult passage of their lives, I will try to speak for them to you, their loved ones and caregivers. I will speak with one voice representing their many voices, communicating the emotional, practical, and spiritual needs of a human being facing imminent death. I need to talk about my thoughts and fears. I'm going through so many changes. I feel so uncertain about my future. Sometimes all I can see in front of me are those future things I am afraid of. And each day my fear ignites a different emotion. Some days I can't take it in and I need to believe it isn't happening. So there might be days or even weeks that I will feel sad or act irritated. If you can listen and accept me, without trying to change or fix my mood, I will eventually get over it and be able to relax, and perhaps even laugh with you again. Until now, you may have always expected me to be emotionally strong and in control. Now I'm afraid that if I honestly reveal myself, you will think less of me. Because of the extreme stresses I am going through, it might happen that the very worst sides of my personality, the real dregs, will get stirred up. If that happens, I need permission to be lost in the woods for a while. Don't worry, I will come back. Do you know that I'm afraid to express my true thoughts and feelings? What if everyone I care about runs away and leaves me all alone? After all, you might not believe how hard this really is. That's why I need you to reassure me that you understand my suffering and that you are willing to stay with me through the process of my dying. I need to know that you will listen to me, respect me, and accept me, no matter what sort of mood I am in on any particular day. Here's the most important thing. I want you to see me as a whole person, not as a disease or a tragedy or a fragile piece of glass. Do not look at me with pity, but rather with all of your love and compassion. Even though I am facing death, I am still living. I want people to treat me normally and to include me in their lives. Don't think that you cannot be completely with me. It is okay to tell me if I'm making your life harder or that you are feeling afraid or sad. More than anything, I need you to be honest now. There is no more time for us to play games or to hide from each other. I would love to know I am not the only one feeling vulnerable and afraid. When you come in acting cheerful and strong, I sometimes feel I must hide my real self from you. When we only talk of superficial things, I feel even lonelier. Please come in and allow me to be myself and try to tune in to what is going on with me that day. How healing it would be for me to have someone to share my tears with. Don't forget, we're going to have to say goodbye to each other one day soon. And if we have a rocky history between us, don't you think it would be easier if we could start by acknowledging it? This doesn't mean I want you to rekindle the same old disagreements. I would like it if we could simply acknowledge our past difficulties, forgive each other, and let go. If we don't communicate like this, and instead stay in hiding from each other, then whenever you visit me, we will feel the strain of that which remains unspoken. Believe me, I already feel much more aware of my past mistakes, and I feel bad about the ways I might have hurt you. Please allow me to acknowledge them and say I am sorry. Then we can see each other afresh and enjoy the time we have left together. Now more than ever, I need you to be reliable. When we make plans and you are late or do not come at all, you don't realize how much you've really let me down. Thinking that I will have one visitor on a given day can make all the difference in how much I am able to bear my pain or emotional distress. Each moment spent with a friend who really cares and accepts me is like a warm light shining in a very difficult, lonely, and frightening existence. When you come into the room, can you meet my gaze? I wish you would take the time to really look into my eyes and see what I am truly feeling. I long for friends to embrace me, or at least touch my shoulder, hold my hand, or gently stroke my face. Please don't hold back your affection and your love. In the hospital, I sometimes feel more like an object or a disease rather than a human being. Please bring in your humanity and kindness to ease my suffering. Because no matter how I might seem on the outside, gruff, withdrawn, cheerful, bitter, or mentally impaired, inside, I am suffering, and I am very lonely and afraid. Even though this is a difficult time in my own life, often my main worry is about how my condition is affecting my loved ones. They seem so lost, so burdened, so alone with all of the changes they are experiencing and all the responsibilities they shoulder. And what about their future? How are they going to cope after I am gone? I'm afraid I am leaving them stranded and alone. Some days, when everyone comes in with different emotions and needs, I am too weak to handle it all. I can't possibly listen to everyone and all of their burdens. I would be so relieved if someone could help my closest family members contact a counselor or an organization like a hospice who could support them, listen to their needs and their sadness, and maybe even help out in practical ways. Saying goodbye is so very hard for both of us. But if we don't, and if you are resisting my death when I have begun the process of dying, it will be even harder for me to let go. I would like to live longer, yet I cannot struggle anymore. Please do not hold this against me, or urge me to fight when all my strength is gone. I need your blessings now, your acceptance of me and of what is happening to me. Tell me it is all right for me to die, even if I appear unconscious or in great pain. And tell me you are letting me go, with your warmest wishes and all the courage you can muster in this moment. One of my deepest, most powerful fears is that I will be reduced to the situation of an infant, helpless and incoherent. I fear that you will forget who I am and treat me with disrespect. Even thinking about others taking care of my most intimate needs makes me feel ashamed. And every step closer to death makes me realize I will soon be totally dependent on others. Please try to understand when I resist giving in to one more change, one more loss. Help me to take care of myself, even in little ways, so that it will be easier to tolerate the bigger changes which are coming. Speak directly to me, rather than over my head, or as though I were not in the room. Find out what my wishes are for my medical care during the time of dying, while I can still articulate them. And please honor and respect my wishes, ensuring they get written down and communicated. When everyone treats me as though they know what is best for me, I get so angry. Aren't I the person who is ill? Isn't this my life and my body? Don't I have a right to know what is going on? To know if I am living or dying? I need to know what my condition is. I need to know, in the doctor's best estimate, how much time I have left. If you find the courage to tell me what is going on, then I can decide which type of care is right for me. Then I can make decisions about my life. If we stop hiding the truth about my imminent death, I will be able to wrap up the details of my life and prepare my family to survive after I'm gone. You know, the pain can be unbearable sometimes. On other days, the pain is just there, like a bad toothache, and I get tense and irritable. Please forgive me when I am in a bad mood. You may not know what it is like to live with constant pain and discomfort. What is hardest is when no one believes the amount of pain I am having. That makes me feel crazy. I need to be believed, and I need to have my pain relieved. But please don't knock me unconscious to do it. I would rather experience a little pain and still be conscious, to enjoy my life and my family, and to do my spiritual practice while I am in the last few weeks of life. One of the most important ways you could offer practical help would be to act as an advocate for my needs. When I am ill and weak, I may lose my ability to communicate what I want and need. Perhaps some hospital rules can be relaxed to accommodate my lifestyle, my family, and my personal needs. My loved ones might need reassurance or encouragement to take a break from caregiving duties when they become too emotional or stressed. And legally, help me to plan ahead of time whatever practical arrangements are necessary so that I can prepare for a peaceful atmosphere at the time of my death. And what happens if my mind starts to disintegrate? How long will you visit me then? I hope you will not give up communicating with me when my words come out garbled or when I can't speak at all. Do not forget that underneath the seeming confusion or unconsciousness, I am still there. I can still hear you. I can even feel the quality of our relationship. I might be feeling lonely and afraid, though. I always need your love and your reassurance. In order to help me, I hope you can learn to be deeply peaceful inside and receptive so that you can sense what I am feeling and needing and know how to respond appropriately. As my body and mind disintegrate, remember that inside I am still the person I was when my life was at its peak, and thus I am always worthy of kindness and respect. No matter how far gone I appear to be, trust that your love and heartfelt prayers do get through and deeply reassure my entire being. Please don't give up on me when the going gets rough. This is our last chance to heal our relationship and to give to each other our last gifts of love, forgiveness, and wisdom. Being in the hospital makes me feel so restricted. It's hard to give up the patterns of my normal lifestyle, my ability to enjoy the company of my friends, my favorite activities, and even my usual waking and sleeping patterns. It's hard to lose my privacy. In the hospital, I feel so exposed and vulnerable. I miss the home-cooked meals, the family celebrations, and my favorite music. It's hard, in this controlled and public environment, to find a space to share our intimacy and our grief without fear of being interrupted. When I'm hospitalized, I yearn to have a connection to the outside world, to nature, to the beautiful changes of weather and seasons and wind. Do I have to be cut off from all that I love and cherish even while I am living? I might prefer to die at home. If you called a hospice program, they could show you how to arrange for me to be cared for at home as long as you can manage it. Being at home would make the process of dying more bearable. I understand that if you have the responsibilities of work and raising your family, you might have to put me in a hospital. But please do not abandon me there. Help make the hospital environment more like home. Try and spend the night when you can. And even if I have to be hospitalized for most of the period of my dying, I would be grateful if you could arrange with the hospice nurses to bring me home for at least the last few days of my life. What a relief that would be, to be cared for in my familiar surroundings, with family and friends keeping vigil, meditating, praying, or simply talking with me to help relieve my fears and my loneliness. I need help reflecting on my life so I can make sense of it. What meaning did my life have? What have I accomplished? How have I changed and grown? I need to know you will not judge me, so that I can honestly face and reveal my life to you. Encourage me to acknowledge my regrets, so that I can make up with anyone I've neglected or harmed and ask for their forgiveness. Sometimes, when I look back on it, my life seems to be one continuous string of mistakes, or a legacy of selfishness and disregard for others. Remind me of what I have accomplished, of any good I have done, so I can know that in some way I have contributed to your life. Please don't feel you must have all the answers or wise words to assuage my fears. You might come to my side feeling anxious, not knowing what to say. You don't have to pretend or keep up a strong facade. To really offer me spiritual support, I need you to be a human being first. Have the courage to share with me your uncertainty, your fear, your genuine sadness for the immense loss we are facing. Going through these difficult feelings together, establishing a deep bond and trust, I will feel safe enough to begin letting go, and I'll be able to face my death with more equanimity and an open heart. After you have listened to my painful stories or complaints, remind me that I am more than my fear or my sadness, my pain or my anger. Help me understand that whatever suffering I am going through is natural. It's part of the human condition. Remind me that my painful emotional or physical condition, no matter how seemingly solid and real, will pass. If I seem to be lost in my own suffering, help me to remember that there is still one positive thing I can do. Extend my love and compassion toward others. Tell me the ways my life has touched yours. In whatever way you can reach me, help me to connect to the inner goodness, which is the most essential part of my being. How can my process of dying have meaning? When I'm lying here, weak and helpless, I am tempted to feel that the remainder of my life is useless. Everyone has to do everything for me, and it's so hard to feel that I have nothing left to contribute. If you ask, you might find there is something I do have to offer you, the insights about life and about death that I've recently gained. Would you allow me to give you whatever final gifts I have? Sometimes the thought of death terrifies. At the same time, I also feel strangely peaceful and even curious about the adventure that is ahead. Yet it is a journey for which I may not have prepared. It won't help if you try to give me your own beliefs and answers about death. I need you to help me discover my own philosophy, my own inner resources and confidence. But if you are grounded in a spiritual tradition which gives you strength, which helps you work through your own suffering, perhaps you can find ways to open windows and doors of hope for me. Perhaps all you need to do is tell me your own story, without any expectations attached. With time, if you give me your love and your trust, I will work something out deep inside me. What will happen to me after I've died? What will count then? Help me find images of death which inspire rather than frighten me, so I can trust that what I am going toward is good. What I don't like is to feel I must simply give up and die. Perhaps you can help me find a way to meet death in a more positive way, calling on the best qualities of wisdom and authentic compassion within me. Maybe, like the prodigal son, I have been wandering far away from my home and my truth. Dying might be the process to help me find my own way home, so I can make my peace with God or my inner truth. Perhaps you could learn which spiritual practices, prayers or meditations, sacred readings or music, are inspiring for me, and sit by my side and practice with me whenever you visit. Finding a spiritual practice that fills my heart with confidence, devotion, and compassion will help me to feel more prepared for death. I would be grateful if you could arrange whatever is necessary with the hospital staff and my family so that the atmosphere when I am dying is loving and peaceful and will be conducive to spiritual practice. And please do not worry or feel bad if I die when you are not by my side. Sometimes your presence is soothing, but sometimes your being there makes it harder for me to leave. Please say and do whatever you need to early on, and then you won't have regrets if I should die unexpectedly soon. And when you learn I have died, please let go of any guilt. Remember that I am grateful for all you have done, and what I need most is your kindness, your sincere and heartfelt prayers, wishing me well, and letting me go.
The five psychological stages of dying and medical issues around death. By Mitchell Gersten, M.D. The process of dying is neither easy nor simple. Disengagement from the body often requires significant effort and may be associated with pain or other discomforts that can limit our ability to be fully present for the process. For some, disentangling from the physiology that has supported and nurtured us is challenging, and those challenges frequently increase when clinging to this life is coupled with fear about what may happen after death. I have observed many ways by which people undergo this process. In a medical setting, at least in America, it seems that the process begins when a person is informed about a diagnosis which will, in time, lead to their death. The knowledge of one's impending end rushes in unimpeded, like water through a breached dam. There is no escape, and no method short of complete denial that can relieve such a person of that certainty. The death process truly begins at the moment of conception. At the same instant that the processes creating life are initiated, the processes of dissolution are also set into motion. It is impossible to have one without the other. In absence of a defined disease process, people frequently seem incapable of grasping these fundamental truths, let alone allowing them to inform and guide their lives. While this may be acknowledged in the same fashion as the body's other needs, it is almost an afterthought, a subtle sensation that can, if one chooses, be ignored. Even in the face of observing the disease and death process in those around us, denial reigns supreme. The belief of our own exemption from this process guides our own planning, our attitudes, and our decisions, leading us to unrealistic expectations about living, as well as avoidance of full participation in our own death. The five psychological stages of dying. Failure to recognize this early in life leads to the full expression of the five psychological stages of dying that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross has written about. In my observations of patients confronted with the reality of their impending deaths, these five stages, while not always fully expressed, frequently manifest. These five stages form a useful framework with which we can look at the processes of death to better understand it in others as well as in ourselves. The five stages are not necessarily a linear process. They can happen in any order, and one can skip back and forth between the stages. But the stages often follow their traditional sequence. These stages are longer or shorter in different people, largely on the basis of one's prior preparations for death, one's sense of satisfaction with how one's life was lived, as well as the depth of one's grasping to the memories of life. I have already mentioned the first stage, that of denial, and while this is clearly present when a fatal diagnosis is given, it is present more subtly long before such information is provided. The more powerful one's denial, the more intense are those feelings when the truth is fully grasped. This appears in different ways. People often discuss their plans for the future, for meetings or excursions that will likely never occur. The planning can be so full of detail and verve that an observer can be lulled into feeling that there really is a chance that these events will occur. The dying individual works hard to convince everyone, and perhaps most importantly themselves, that their process of death is an error, and that their efforts at long-term planning can erase the messages given them by physicians, or frequently by their own bodies. This often leads to the next stage, anger. Anger develops when the truth of one's death is finally acknowledged. One's resistance appears with such force that the emotional outbursts can be intense and overwhelming, for the individual as well as for caregivers. Anger can be expressed externally, directed at others over minor issues. Nothing is right, and inconsequential concerns are blown out of proportion. To incredulous observers and those unaware of this process, it can be frustrating and bewildering. The dying person often expresses exasperation at the fact that they themselves are in such a situation. They wonder how this could have happened and how this can be happening to them. This stage can go on for days or weeks. Gradually, as resistance is worn away by the relentless truth of their situation, the next stage emerges, that of bargaining. At this point, death is acknowledged, but attempts are made to reason with whatever power is perceived to be in charge or in control of these matters. Offers are tendered to gain more time to see a given event occur, to complete a project, to clean up old business, or to complete communication with others. When it is realized that no amount of supplication can alter the fact of one's impending death, and particularly for the unprepared, the stage of depression develops. People withdraw from communication, choosing to relinquish any participation in life. There is risk of the depression becoming pervasive and permanent. It is not necessary for this stage to be passed through before the last of the five stages is reached. Acceptance, the last stage, is generally achieved when all one's denial has been exhausted, when anger is shown to be of no use, when entreaties clearly fall on deaf ears, and when depression itself is unable to change the fact of one's death. Here, at last, is a genuine opportunity for peace, for appeasing the disparate emotional forces that drove the prior stages. When the dying person is finally able to embrace the process, there emerges a more relaxed state, a tranquility, even joy. While the dying may not be pleased about their death, the certainty of the process is fully grasped, and with that comes acceptance. The five stages in loved ones. Loved ones can go through similar stages. The healthier, the more open, and the more communicative is the relationship between the dying individual and the loved ones, the more relaxed is the process of release. However, this is often difficult for the loved ones. The stages described previously for the dying are readily mirrored in loved ones and friends. As such, it is crucial that those caring for the dying remain in touch with their own emotional states, to be more present, compassionate, and helpful to the one dying. Each one of the five stages can powerfully influence the dying if the caregivers are ignorant of their operation, within themselves and within those dying. Indeed, unrecognized expression of these stages in loved ones and caregivers can make the dying process more difficult for the dying person. Denial of death by a loved one can confer false hope or foster delusional ideas about survival in the dying. It can confuse the dying person if those around them do not support the reality of their death. Any anger expressed can be disturbing, a source of bewilderment, and deplete the energy of the dying person as they try to appease it. Caregivers often do their own bargaining with some higher authority to somehow stave off their loved one's death. They may attempt to bargain with the dying person themselves, as if they have enough control over their own death to delay or reverse it. Depending on where the dying are in their process, they may wish to participate in the covenant, however unreasonable or unrealistic. Caregivers may discuss future events that they hope the dying can attend, such as a wedding, a birth, or graduation. There are often attempts to cajole the dying to linger so that unfinished emotional business can be completed. At some point, this can give way to depression. The loved one fully realizes the loss, and this often leads to overwhelming sadness, a profound sense of impotence that for some never disappears. Those with some insight into this process will work through this stage to finally reach a place of acceptance. This is critical, not only to the individual left behind, but also for the dying. It can make the release from this life that much easier when a sense of responsibility for others can be relinquished. Biological changes. In addition to these emotional changes, there are many physical changes that are helpful to know. While there are similarities in each death, there are also vast differences. The process can be short, taking moments to hours, or it can be long, taking days to weeks. Most of the deaths I have observed reveal some discomfort. It is rare to watch someone die without distress. Those who die easily simply close their eyes and gradually breathe less, and eventually not at all. There may be moments of lucidity where they seem to awaken and engage whoever might be at their bedside. They may speak clearly about their lives, offering pearls of wisdom from what they have seen, both from memory and from their pre-death reveries. This phase may last moments, hours, or days before they lapse into unconsciousness. From observing people die, I have often felt that whatever it is that forms personality, one's core being, one's spirit, departs at this time. As breathing decreases, the death rattle, which sounds like the blowing of bubbles through a narrow tube, is often heard, and is the result of mucus, blood, or other fluid accumulating in the throat. After breathing stops, there may be random contractions of the heart until it too ceases. After this, biochemical activity persists at the molecular and cellular level, and the body begins to decay and smell. For months, or even years prior to death, the process that will ultimately lead to death labors at subtle levels, with only occasional glimpses seen on the surface. A person's color becomes sickly yellowish, their skin more dense or thickened. You may observe this for a few days or hours before the person recaptures the appearance you are more accustomed to, and you may wonder if what you saw was real. Their energy levels and zeal for activity, requiring more than a baseline level of input, may wax and wane. At those times, you may question how your dying friend or family member feels about you, as it can seem like they are becoming more aloof or withdrawn. And indeed, many are, for the world that you are so engaged in no longer holds the same excitement that it does for you. As their bodies slowly disintegrate, so does their willingness to extend their spirits beyond the frontier of their skin. They become increasingly withdrawn. With time, you may observe the effects of their dying process manifest more obviously on that skin. That yellow color is now undeniable. The yellowing of the skin or eyes in people with progressive liver failure, for example, becomes increasingly apparent. The tone of their skin darkens and sullies, or may begin to turn shades of blue as their skin becomes less oxygenated. With that loss of circulation, the skin may break down, in some cases seeming to dissolve before you, leaving an open wound that may become infected and draining, malodorous, or frankly putrid. This will become even more apparent to you should you be a caregiver, the one cleaning wounds and changing dressings. You may have to steel yourself against the possibility of retching, which you will not want to do for fear of offending or embarrassing the dying person. Even those most familiar with death are challenged by the harsh biological reality of dissolution. Depending on the person's illness, there may develop a faint yet unmistakable odor. The smell may be sweet and fruity, like fermenting honey or rotting fruit, or slightly foul, noticeable but not yet overwhelming. Initially, the dying person may be aware of this, and perhaps even ashamed or apologetic for it. In time, this concern usually passes as just another inconsequential worldly concern, despite the increase of the odor. Depending upon the underlying illness, a person becomes progressively weaker and less able to move, sit up in bed, to feed themselves, or to willfully urinate or defecate. The dying will frequently be unable to inform caregivers of any impending need to void, and will urinate or expel stool in the bed without warning. They may be unable to inform you that this has happened, and it is only the worsening of foul odors that alerts you to the need to clean them. At this point, they will be likely confined to bed, unable to care for even the slightest personal need. We come into this world as infants, unable to control our bodily functions, and we often leave the world with the same lack of control. From the cradle to the grave, we rely on the kindness and understanding of our caregivers to help us. Many dying people develop an astonishing lack of concern for things that seem so important to us. They may seem unconcerned with people or goings-on around them. On the other hand, some may express an excessive concern about the moods, feelings, or needs of others. As caregivers, it is helpful to know the gamut of possible expressions. At some point, the person loses consciousness. We can think of this juncture in a number of different ways. Perhaps at the time earthly consciousness is permanently lost, the dying person's spirit or soul in some way leaves the body, or is present but disengaged, or perhaps hovering nearby. The disembodied consciousness is unable to apply any motive force to its former flesh, let alone communicate with those left behind. It may be useful to recall that this body we inhabit is a collection of finely tuned biochemical mechanisms motivated by the force of physical energy, calories, and by the presence of spirit. This spirit is both tightly bound to and intimately interactive with the body's physical processes. Thinking about it in this way, it can be seen that once the dying person's spirit disengages and emerges from the body, all that remains is the residual energy in the body's biochemical stores, which will persist in expressing themselves through the common and familiar pathways they have moved through during life. This means, for example, that the diaphragm will still move up and down, sustaining the remnants of breath. So while it may appear that the dying person is breathing, this should not be construed as the taking of breath, or more esoterically as the mixing of prana with flesh. In my opinion, this only occurs when the spirit is present and the movement of breath consciously motivated. In this setting, that is not the case. At this point, it can therefore be useful to think of the dying body as merely expending its remaining stores of energy, much as a wind-up toy slowly becomes less animated as the spring gradually uncoils. As the body loses energy, the eyes draw in and sink deeper into the skull, and the cheeks collapse. It is as if there is an internal vacuum sucking away any energetic investment from the external appearance of the body. The skin becomes dull, acquiring the feel of unworked leather. The abdomen crumples inward and flesh hangs, listless and empty. Even in people who are heavy in life, there develops an obvious concavity at the belly as the bony lower ribs form a shelf from which hangs the now dull and heavy flesh. The weight of the musculature, pulled by gravity, stretches the skin downward. All remaining sphincter tone releases, and if there is stool remaining in the rectum, it often leaks out at this point. From here on, what was once imbued with life is now irrevocably and undeniably a corpse. While I have described the simplest of death processes, the vast majority of deaths are not this predictable or straightforward. Regardless of the many events that can lead to death, there comes a threshold that leads irreversibly into death. This threshold can be mental, as in a resolute decision to die, but most often it is a physical threshold. Depending upon the physiological and biological nature of the process of death, it can be a gentle unraveling or an unpleasant or even violent one. It is therefore useful for caregivers and loved ones to be aware of what can occur and thereby be prepared. Hydration, nutrition, and pain control. Family and friends often feel impotent around death, or constrained from interacting with the process of dying. Even if we are inclined to act, this process is so removed from our normal experience that we don't know what to ask, when to ask it, or what to do to help. The first thing to know is that it is difficult to really injure a person who is already dying. This varies, of course, depending on the stage that the dying person is in. Early on, the dying person can acutely feel pain or thirst, but as the process progresses, things that we might consider noxious are perceived by the dying as either benign or they are not perceived at all. This is important because it can inform the caregivers in terms of what to ask for and when. questions regularly emerge about hydration, nutrition, and anxiety or pain control. When is it appropriate to give fluids? Do we need to be concerned about caloric intake or how to administer that? If we give narcotics to relieve the pain, will that accelerate death? The answers are specific to the individual who is dying, yet a few general comments can be made. There has been much discussion about hydration. Many healthcare workers think that dehydration is uncomfortable for people and have advocated keeping intravenous fluids going as a patient dies. I have done this myself, and although I have been directly involved with many patients as they die, I have no way to assess whether or not it is true that they suffer from dehydration. This idea may come from our own memory of being dehydrated and the ensuing discomfort, a feeling that we then unwittingly project onto the dying. With this said, it is relatively benign to have an IV in place. Given that this may alleviate some discomfort and is minimally invasive and non-toxic, it is reasonable to give fluids to a dying person. However, this does not mean that extreme measures need to be taken to gain IV access. If a simple buff cap, an IV catheter, cannot be maintained, I would not advocate more aggressive measures to obtain IV access. In these instances, moistened cotton washcloths applied to the lips, a few ice chips placed in the mouth from time to time, or, if the person is able, a few sips of water, may be all that can be offered, and all that is needed. As for nutrition, in my experience, this is not an area where invasive procedures have much value. There are basically three ways to provide nutrition for a dying person. It helps to know about these in case the doctors provide these options. First, a nasogastric tube, or a tube known as a Dobhoff, which is much thinner and more pliable than a standard NG. Second, a PEG tube, percutaneous endoscopic gastrostomy, which is a device placed through the abdominal wall directly into the stomach. This is accomplished via a scope passed down through the esophagus into the stomach, at the same time that an incision is made through the abdominal and stomach walls. What amounts to a grommet is placed in that newly created hole, and, with that in place, tubes can be threaded directly into the stomach for infusion of liquid nutritional supplements. Third, nutrition is delivered intravenously through a technique known as TPN, or total parenteral nutrition. This requires placement of a central intravenous catheter, which is either located in the internal jugular or subclavian vein. A more easily placed PICC line, peripheral intravenous central catheter, can also be used. With the exception of the first of these three options, these are all invasive techniques and, with the exception of the first option, carry considerable costs. Prior to embarking on any of these approaches, a fundamental question needs to be answered. What is the ultimate goal of providing nutrition in this setting? If we can agree that the person is in fact dying, then from my point of view, there is nothing to be gained by providing nutrition. Indeed, what we may be doing is unnecessarily prolonging their suffering. In many instances, families or medical proxy decision makers opt to provide nutrition when guidance from the dying person is not available. This is why advanced directives are so important. Tell your family and friends before you die what you want them to do. Well-intentioned but misinformed loved ones, out of fear of doing the wrong thing or of somehow being judged adversely that their wrong decision not to provide nutrition contributed to an accelerated death, often request artificial nutrition. Always remember that the person is dying, and none of our actions will ultimately change that fact. A guiding principle in making any of these decisions is this. Is my decision going to contribute to my loved one's further pain and suffering? In other words, the decision to provide artificial nutrition can have the opposite of our intended effect. Instead of relieving them of their suffering, we may be contributing to it. Consideration of pain and anxiety management is vital. Many caretakers are reluctant to give narcotics because of our culture's obsession with addiction and the stigma of opiates. Let me be very clear. This is not the time to be concerned with these issues. If a dying person is in pain, it is absolutely incumbent upon us to alleviate that pain. This generally means one of the many forms of narcotics which should, in my opinion, be offered liberally. With this said, it is important to understand that narcotics can accelerate death. They do so by directly suppressing the respiratory control centers in the brain, and in so doing reduce the rate and depth of breathing. This is the double edge of pain control which must be understood by caregivers. We do not have to limit decisions regarding their use, but rather to better understand the implications of their use. Many of these decisions must be made with the assistance of doctors, some of whom will have differing views to your own, or to the previously expressed wishes of the dying person. This is where your advocacy becomes critical. Express clearly what you believe is needed. If you have been granted medical decision-making powers by the dying person, exercise those powers with clarity and wisdom. Think about what your loved one would want. Do not be intimidated into withholding your views, and do not be shy about requesting what you believe is needed to best assist your loved one. But also, don't be belligerent in expressing your views. Be firm yet gentle when dealing with professional caregivers. Doctors are human beings, often fallible, and often bringing their own views on mortality, including those informed by their religious beliefs or fears. This is the time when the dying person's needs and requests, and your best understanding and advocacy of them, are the priority. It's not about the doctors, and it's not about you. Sometimes we need to remind ourselves and to remind them. As much as the dying person sometimes needs permission to let go, sometimes physicians require a similar insight. This is entirely about your loved one's process of dying, and how that can be eased or facilitated. Physical Signs and Symptoms of Dying by Andrew Holacek. Depending on a person's age, their disease, and a host of other factors, there are stages that a dying person goes through as they approach death. As with the spiritual stages of dying, not everyone experiences every stage or the signs and symptoms associated with it. They can also occur in a variety of sequences. Signs are objective indicators of a condition, like blood in the stool or a rash. They are visible to others. Symptoms are subjective, like fatigue or pain. They are often not apparent to others. If you're the one diagnosed with a terminal illness, ask your doctor how people usually die from this disease and how it tends to progress. Learn about the signs and symptoms you may experience. Each sign and symptom is part of a natural process that occurs as the functions of various organs shut down. If decisions have been made not to alter this natural process, none of these signs or symptoms indicate a medical emergency or require treatments to reverse them. But steps can be taken to make them less painful. An increase in pain is common during the dying process, whether it's an existing pain or something new. The golden rule is that no one needs to suffer from physical pain at the end of life. This is the role of hospice care and palliative or comfort-only medicine. If your doctor is not familiar or comfortable with aggressive pain management, find someone who is. Once again, don't worry about addiction. Worry about making the dying person comfortable. Many doctors say that when a dying person hints at suicide or requests euthanasia, it often comes from unmanaged physical pain. In the case of sudden death, cardiac arrest, stroke, or trauma, none of the following signs may occur. Someone may also die from a combination of gradual and sudden causes. A patient suffering from end-stage cancer, for example, may suddenly die from a stroke. In the case of sudden death, there is often greater confusion because there's less time to prepare. The main issue to prepare for with sudden death concerns resuscitation. Do you rush the patient to the emergency room? Do you perform CPR? Or do you let them go? Because decisions have to be made quickly, it's important to have advanced directives, especially documents like DNR, do not resuscitate. Did the dying person empower someone with a durable medical power of attorney? Were advanced directives communicated to family and loved ones? These uncomfortable issues should be settled in advance to lessen the shock of sudden illness and death. In a gradual death, energy is slowly concentrated in the organs essential for life, the heart, lungs, and brain. Circulation to the extremities and to the skin, muscles, liver, stomach, kidneys, and bladder decreases. This causes many of the signs and symptoms discussed shortly. Loss of appetite, concentrated or decreased volumes of urine, discoloration of the extremities, cooling, itching, and breakdown of the skin. Caregivers can offer comfort by first accepting these sometimes disconcerting events and then reassuring the dying person, if they are even aware of these changes, that this is a natural process. As circulation to the digestive system lessens, the dying person loses interest in eating and drinking. A person with advanced illness may lose interest in food and drink weeks before they have circulatory changes, which may be one of the first signs that they are entering terminal stages. This is the time to discuss artificial nutrition and hydration. But again, think about how these measures may only serve to sustain artificial life. Balance artificial life with authentic death. The changes in body chemistry associated with no fluids or food is thought to have natural pain-relieving effects. The body has its own internal pharmacy and knows what to do and when to do it. It writes, fills, and administers the proper dosage of a host of natural prescriptions. While these sometimes need to be supplemented, especially pain medications, don't get in the way of the body's inherent wisdom. Intravenous fluids are often administered near the end of life. I took my father to the hospital many times to get him rehydrated. This can be briefly effective, but not if one is nearing death. As the kidneys lose their function, IV fluids can worsen other symptoms, such as shortness of breath or choking due to increased secretions. These secretions also contribute to the disconcerting death rattle. Swelling or edema is commonly seen in lower extremities and sometimes throughout the body as death approaches. Ankles and shins often get puffy. Artificial hydration can make this worse. Diuretics can make it better. As death approaches, what we perceive as dehydration is probably proper hydration that actually makes the dying person more comfortable. Artificial nutrition or hydration is sometimes strongly encouraged by nursing homes and other facilities that receive higher reimbursement for patients receiving this level of care. Be polite but firm in enforcing your informed and genuine care. Swelling is abnormal in healthy people, but normal for those who are dying. As the process of dying progresses, it becomes harder to swallow and therefore easier to choke on fluids or food. Despite the urge to make someone feel better by trying to nourish them, often because we associate food with expressions of love, don't force the dying person to eat or drink. Doing so can cause distress to a system that's no longer functioning. The person may swallow, but immediately vomit. Feeding them may make you feel better, but it can make them feel worse. Now is the time to switch from physical to spiritual nutrition. Even though he or she may appear increasingly emaciated, the dying person is often not hungry. They're not starving to death, they're simply dying. The body's natural morphine, endorphin, is often released during this end phase of life and serves to lessen the pain of dying. Offering sips of water or water on a swab will keep the mouth, lips, and tongue moist and comfortable. I have used an eyedropper to deliver water when the end is near. A fever may develop as hydration progresses. Tylenol suppositories can control the fever and prevent seizures. It helps to place a cool, moistened washcloth on the forehead or to sponge the limbs. Putting a humidifier in the room also helps. The body loses its ability to control its temperature, causing the person to feel hot 1 minute and cold the next. Add or remove blankets as needed, but avoid electric blankets, which can cause burns. Change perspiration-soaked garments and linens to keep the patient comfortable. Because of the decrease in fluids and food, urine and stool amounts decrease. Urine becomes concentrated and dark, and several days may lapse between bowel movements. You don't want bowel movements to cease entirely, which could indicate the development of a painful bowel impaction. My father had to go to the emergency room to relieve this condition. Milk of magnesia or other laxatives should be used if a bowel movement doesn't occur within 3 days. When someone stops eating, the body begins to metabolize muscle and tissue mass, eating itself in a sense, and feces continues to form. This later form of fecal matter may have little or no odor. New patterns of waste elimination can develop, and the consistency and color of the stool often changes. Loss of control over bladder or bowel functions may occur days or even weeks before death, or when the muscles relax at the moment of death. Protect the mattress with plastic and provide waterproof padding under the patient for increased comfort. If they can't make it to the bathroom or commode, portable toilet, use a bedpan or pee bottle, which are separately designed for men and women. When they can no longer move, ask the hospice nurse about urinary catheters or disposable adult briefs. Because the organs are shutting down, the dying person withdraws from the world and spends more time sleeping or resting with their eyes closed. They often become increasingly difficult to arouse, and we should avoid the temptation to do so. This is their time. They are doing what they need to do. Heed the natural wisdom of the body. Don't shake the body, speak loudly, or try to force a response. Talk to them in a normal voice, even though there may be no apparent response. Don't say anything in their presence that you wouldn't say to them when they're awake. Don't assume they can't hear you. These are all reasons why we should say our goodbyes early in the dying process. The dying person's withdrawal is a sign that their body is starting to say goodbye. We should use that sign to begin our own goodbyes. Missing the chance to say what's in our hearts can cause unnecessary regret. Death often happens faster than we might expect. Because it can be hard for the dying person to let go when a loved one is present, they often die when no one is around. They frequently grasp onto life because they feel the force of your grasping onto them. As circulation to the extremities decreases, their arms, hands, legs, and feet become increasingly cool, and often manifest a purplish blotching, called mottling. This is frequently accompanied with breakdown of the skin, another indication of the decrease in blood flow. Moisturizers can be applied to the skin. If wounds or sores develop, use antibiotic ointment and non-adhesive bandages over the sores. Move or turn the body every few hours to prevent these bed sores. Dying people often love to be touched, so massaging in some lotion is usually welcome. They don't want to be viewed as an untouchable, but as a human being just like you. A yellowish pallor often manifests, which should not be confused with jaundice. The eyes often rest with lids partly open and can become dry. Artificial teardrops placed every few hours will keep the eyes moist. Even when seemingly unconscious, some dying people will suddenly have muscle spasms or even seizures. Most hospice workers and professional caregivers are aware of these signs and symptoms. They are trained to manage them. Respect their work. Be sensitive if you offer suggestions or feel the urge to complain. There are times, however, when workers neglect their duties, and sometimes even abuse the dying person. As an advocate for your dying loved one, speak gently but firmly. Don't vent onto them. Always check your motivation and remember that the intensity of the situation can trigger irrational emotions as you struggle to cope with your own pain. Angry outbursts are common from both the dying person and stressed-out loved ones. As death approaches, blood flow to the brain decreases, which causes disorientation and drowsiness. Even family members may go unrecognized. The dying person may be confused as to where they are or what's happening. They may become restless, pulling at bed linens, trying to get up, or reaching for imaginary things. This often worsens in the evening. Sedatives like Ativan, lorazepam, in liquid form, can be used every 4 hours or even hourly as needed. Sedatives calm not only the patient, seeing them tranquil, will calm you. The dying may report strange dreams or conversations with dead people. All kinds of unusual, nonsensical, and confusing statements can be uttered, even shouted. These indicate the loss of cognitive function and the loss of grounding in physical reality. The dying person is in a psychic place we do not comprehend, dipping in and out of varying states of consciousness, from dreamlike internal mindscapes to confused waking landscapes. They are often unable to distinguish between the two. To get some idea of what the dying may be experiencing, remember those states of mind that are partly awake and partly asleep, hypnagogic and hypnopompic states associated with pre- and post-dreaming. Mix in some pain, emotional distress, and a vague or clear sense of losing everything you have and everything you are. How would you feel or react? I have been with dying people who start to hallucinate, seeing strange beings as clearly as they see me. They are sinking into Bardo-like realities, partly here and partly gone. You may be curious and ask about those perceived realities, but don't challenge them. For the dying person, those states are real. Your efforts to rescue them by pulling them back to your reality may confuse them even more. If they're looking for reassurance, quietly remind them of where they are and who is present. Comfort them with casual conversation or gentle touch. As they continue to withdraw, however, they may not want to be touched. Be aware of their needs and let those supersede your own. Many of these signs are indications of delirium, a state of disorientation that can happen within a few hours or days before death. Classic symptoms include agitation and irritability, acute mood swings, seeing or hearing things that aren't there, sleeping during the day and staying awake during the night, and difficulty paying attention. Causes of delirium include extreme anxiety, oxygen deprivation, pain, infection, certain medications, and withdrawal from alcohol or medication. Whatever is happening, allow the dying to express themselves unless they're hurting themselves or others. Provide the supportive environment to accept whatever arises without judgment or panic. Reassure them that everything that's happening, as disconcerting as it appears, is part of a natural process. Once again, your stability and presence of mind, often without saying a thing, may provide exactly what they need. I have seen people resist death, flailing about and even becoming violent. Under those extreme conditions, they may need to be heavily sedated or even restrained. This will prevent them from harming themselves and others. Palliative care physician Dr. Daniel Matlock says, "This terminal agitation is common and can be very, very ugly. We use a lot of sedatives in these cases. Sedation is not euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide, because the intent of the sedation is to treat a symptom. It should be understood, however, that the use of sedatives can accelerate the dying process. Identifying yourself in a soft and clear voice helps the dying person reorient to waking reality. This may need to be done repeatedly, but should never be done forcefully. Before you touch them to implement bodily care, inform them of who you are, what you are going to do, and why you are doing it. Because of the cognitive changes and the decrease in oxygenation to the brain, disorientation is a constant companion for the dying person and for loved ones. Knowledge, patience, and understanding reduces the confusion. If the person is dying from a specific disease, learn about that disease and the symptoms that accompany it. Then practice empathy and imagine yourself on that bed. The dying may enter a partial or full coma and no longer respond verbally. If they're not in a coma, their mouth may move as they try to speak, but are unable to. They might communicate with eye movements, a slight nod, or a gentle squeeze of the hand. Reassure them that it's okay and there's no need for them to talk. Remember that we're trying to help them relax. And keep in mind, as nurse Lynn Weitzel says, the spirit does not get cancer or AIDS or Alzheimer's. The relative may be dying. The absolute never dies. When circulation slows to the core, which is to the heart and lungs, the heart may speed up before it slows down and stops. Blood pressure may also spike to unusually high levels, then drop to very low levels. If the death rattle manifests, which again is simply secretions collecting in the airways, turning the body or head to the side helps gravity drain the fluids. Sometimes suction can be used. You can also wipe the mouth with a moist cloth to remove the mucus pooling there. Dr. Matlock says, "I often tell people that the death rattle is more distressing to us than it is to them." There are also medications like scopolamine patches and atropine drops that can dry these secretions. They might try to cough up mucus, and their mouth is often dry and encrusted with secretions. You can cleanse the mouth with glycerin or use mineral oil swabs dipped in cool water to relieve the dryness. Breathing may become shallow and rapid before it slows down. Exhalations are often longer and more pronounced than inhalations. Breathing often becomes labored, accompanied with moaning or even snoring sounds. Raise the head of the bed to help manage this, and remember that moaning is not always a sign of pain. It's usually the sound of air passing over relaxed vocal cords. If breathing is labored, ask the doctor to administer medications that can relieve the respiratory distress. If you're in a nursing home or hospital and do not wish to be intubated and placed on an artificial ventilator, you should have a DNI order in place, which is usually part of a DNR. Narcotics such as morphine also block the sensation of shortness of breath. Your loved one does not have to feel like they're suffocating or drowning. Chain-Stokes breathing can manifest, which is when there are several breaths followed by a period of no breathing. It's often unsettling for loved ones when the dying person suddenly stops breathing. This cessation can last from several seconds to over a minute. If you're at home, supplemental oxygen provided by hospice and repositioning can help. If you're in a care facility, you could have a snug-fitting face mask attached to a breathing machine administered, which is designed to push air into your lungs. This setup doesn't involve intubation. It's called non-invasive positive airway pressure and is similar to the CPAP, continuous positive airway pressure, devices used for sleep apnea. The dying person is literally taking their last gasps of life. But we can ease those gasps. People often want to die in the comfortable and familiar surroundings of their home, although fewer than 20% actually die this way. Even if hospice is involved, they usually don't visit every day. A typical routine might involve the hospice nurse and a home health aide, who deals with bathing and other hygiene concerns, visiting twice a week, either on the same day of the week or on alternating days. A hospice nurse is usually on call 24 hours a day, every day of the week. When a patient first begins hospice care, it's common to call on the nurses every day. The need for advice will diminish once things settle in and you learn how to care for your loved one. A hospice volunteer, whose principal role is emotional and practical support, might come by for a few hours each week. A social worker may visit once a week to coordinate all the above. Unless you have arranged for home health care services outside of hospice, be prepared for some challenging and intimate care. Incontinence is common and can get very messy, even with adult diapers. Sleepless nights are common. The end of life is much like the beginning, but for most people it's easier to change, wipe, or bathe a baby than it is an adult. This is one reason why many people leave their dying loved one in a nursing home. It makes it easier for you, but often harder for your loved one. Ask them beforehand if they're comfortable with you providing this intimate level of care. It could be too embarrassing for them. As a summary, expect these changes: increased sleeping, decreased appetite, difficulty swallowing, decreased urine and fecal output, incontinence, changes in breathing, impaired senses, discoloration of the extremities, restlessness, disorientation, and withdrawal from the world. Death occurs when the heart stops beating and respiration ceases. One can occur before the other, and several minutes can transpire before both finally end. There are two ways to define clinical death, which becomes important in terms of organ donation, that is, when to start harvesting. One, as an irreversible cessation of all the functions of the brain, including the brainstem, and two, as an irreversible cessation of circulation, heartbeat, and breathing. Death is often accompanied by involuntary muscle movements and spasms as the tissues deprived of oxygen fully relax. Because of this relaxation, control of the bladder and bowel ends, often releasing urine and feces. The jaw often drops and the eyes can remain partly open. Everything is exhaling. The person is no longer responsive to verbal commands or to shaking. Blood pools in lower parts of the body, creating purplish bruises. If the body is to be viewed in an open casket, make sure the person is lying on their back. This keeps the face and other visible parts from becoming mottled. Unless organ donation has been arranged, which needs to begin as soon as possible, the body doesn't need to be moved until you're ready. You can keep the body for 24 hours without dry ice and up to 3 days with dry ice. 3 days is pushing it because the body starts to leak fluids. The sense of peace that often pervades the atmosphere after death doesn't need to be filled with activity. Death is not an emergency. It is the end of a completely natural process. Rest in the profundity of what just happened. After my father died, I waited 12 hours before calling hospice. Although death is expected, it frequently remains a surprise. Think ahead about what needs to be done. If hospice is involved, call them and they will initiate post-death action. Once again, with some preparation, you will be able to understand what's happening physically, what might be happening spiritually, and what needs to be done practically. All of which helps everyone relax. It's difficult to predict the amount of time a terminally ill person has left. Hospice nurses and doctors frequently offer varying opinions. I have seen oncologists offer a prognosis of several months, while the general physician sees a few weeks or less. Some of the common indications of the impending death are outlined next. A few months before death, the person begins to withdraw. They lose interest in worldly events, newspapers, magazines, news shows, and then they lose interest in neighbors and friends. Touching and the simple presence of loved ones becomes more important than words. They start to sleep more. Communication and energy decrease. Weakness and fatigue increase. Restlessness and confusion can increase, along with the need to constantly move, or if in bed, to change positions. Monitoring or constantly assisting in this movement is trying for caregivers. Instead of following a 2-year-old around to keep them from hurting themselves, you are now doing so with your elderly loved one. Changes in breathing and the onset or increase of edema often occur. Appetite decreases, nothing tastes good, nausea is evident. Weight loss increases. Liquids are preferred over solids. Meats, vegetables, and other hard-to-digest foods lose their appeal. Eventually, a taste for anything solid disappears. It's as if their inner loss of solidity is being expressed externally. As weakness develops, there is an increased tendency to fall, which often results in broken bones and serious bruising. As the body fails, so does its ability to stave off infections and recover from new bodily stress. And so begins a negative spiral of disease, weakness, and an inability to recover, which leads to more disease, more weakness, and so forth. The list of problems often gets longer as death gets nearer. While we can try to lessen the effects of this spiral, we often can't prevent it. There is often a need to settle unfinished business, practical or emotional. The plumbing needs to be fixed, the house painted, the garden weeded. Family heirlooms suddenly need to be passed along. People often have a deep intuition that something is off and that they are dying. A few weeks before my father went to the doctor, at my urging, he told me over the phone, "I've aged a lot recently. I don't want to die, but I'm ready if I need to." It was a shocking statement and totally out of the blue, but it was the first expression of his impending death, which happened only 2 months later. You may hear things like, "See you next week, if I'm still around. This will probably be my last Thanksgiving. Promise me that you'll take care of, insert name, when I'm gone. I don't need this anymore, take it." A few weeks before death, sleep is more common than being awake. It's difficult for the dying person to keep their eyes open. They're increasingly tired and weak. They may see and converse with loved ones who have died, or perceive things we cannot. They may talk about people and places unknown to others, becoming nonsensical and increasingly confused. Shorter sentences or single words replace full sentences. A cane or walker is needed to move about, and supplemental oxygen may be required. They become wheelchair-bound and eventually bedridden. Toilet lifts, plastic donuts with handrails, which extend the toilet rim and make it easier to sit down and get up, pee bottles so they don't have to get out of bed, commodes or bedpans may be needed. Shower benches, which allow them to sit under the shower, are often needed. At this stage, it's easy for them to fall and break a bone, which would require hospitalization and probably a nursing home. Be gentle but firm in telling them that some activities are no longer possible. Incontinence is common. Once bedridden, movements may become agitated. They might pick at sheets and bedclothes or try to pull out catheters. Bed rails are often needed to keep them from falling out of bed. Hospice provides many of these aids, covered by Medicare: walkers, wheelchairs, oxygen, commodes, hospital beds, where the upper body can be raised and lowered, bedpans, protective coverings, adult diapers, bed rails, etc. A baby monitor, handbell, or other signaling devices helpful so that you know what's going on in the room, or to help them reach out to you. Be prepared for lots of ringing at first. Blood pressure, heart rate, respiration, and body temperature can fluctuate widely. Increased perspiration, coughing, and congestion may occur. Urine concentrates and bowel movements decrease. Skin color changes, mottling develops. Only soft foods or liquids are consumed. A few hours or days before death, fluid intake may decrease markedly. Urine output is low and very dark. Not even soft foods are taken. The dying one may be sleeping or coma-like most of the time. Breathing may become labored, with long pauses, apneas. The jaw may weaken, opening the mouth more. Amazingly, sudden surges of energy may occur, called rallying. Favorite meals, requests to see certain people, and other desires seem to come out of nowhere. After some minutes, hours, or even a few days of this increased awareness and activity, a return to reduced energy and diminished consciousness occurs. If the sudden increase of energy and mentation occur, followed by a return to reduced energy and awareness, the end is usually very near. This final burst of energy can startle loved ones and create the illusion that a miraculous recovery is underway. Restlessness often increases, then drops. Congestion can be marked, the death rattle manifests. Eyes are glassy and not seeing, or constantly closed. The person is unresponsive to speech or touch. Hands and feet become purplish and cool, and feel numb to the dying person. Just before death, fish out of water gasping may arise, and breathing becomes shallow or episodic. Since breath is the marker of life, breathing patterns are often the best indicator for impending death. Spiritual matrix. Lynn Weitzel's comment, "The spirit does not get cancer or AIDS or Alzheimer's," warrants a brief return to the spiritual matrix of all experience. Understanding the spiritual context in which even the most difficult physical events take place can reframe an entire illness or death. This can instill ease into a difficult situation. It's easy for a person afflicted with a disease and for those around them to start to identify with it. While it's important to know about an illness for obvious reasons, what to expect, how to treat it, etc., if we start to identify with the disease, we may contract around it. We may convince ourselves that the pathology is now who we are, or if we're a caregiver, who the patient is. In a recent article on autism, a writer for the New York Times remarked that the diagnosis of autism is in many ways central to their lives. Self-contraction and the ensuing reification is one of our most powerful habits. This is when a disease of the body spreads to infect the mind and spirit. I have seen many patients surrender, unintentionally or even willingly, to a diagnosis. They will tell me about their cancer, for example, and convey a sense of dangerous acquiescence. What can I do about it? My doctor says the prognosis is bleak. This disease has taken control of my life. I'm not blaming doctors, for there are many who deliver their diagnosis with empathy and compassion. There are also many patients who unconsciously enable their doctors, imbuing them with godlike powers of life and death. I'm also not saying that disease doesn't have the ability to overwhelm and adversely transform a person, profoundly changing their physical life. There are diseases where death is virtually guaranteed. What I am saying is that doctors, patients, and caregivers need to be careful when it comes to the promise and peril of diagnosis. It sometimes feels, for example, like some patients have the excuse they have been waiting for to finally get them off the hook of life. They may say to themselves, "I am no longer responsible for my life and my actions. This disease has taken over. Can't you see that this pathology is who I am?" They have become the victim and surrender in a damaging way. Dr. Candace Pert, one of the most eloquent exponents of mind-body medicine, says, "Take responsibility for your own health and illness. Delete phrases like, 'My doctor won't let me,' or 'My doctor says I have name of condition, and there's really nothing I can do,' from your speech and thought patterns. There's a big difference between appreciating a diagnosis and identifying with it. When we talk about surrendering to reality, This is not the surrender we're talking about. Disease may be a temporary physical reality, and living in ignorance of it could lead to the other extreme of living in denial. But this disease is not who we are. Our spirit, who we really are, will never get cancer, and it will never die. Be present for your disease, but don't endorse it. Identify with your immortal spirit, not the malfunction of the body that temporarily contains it. Trungpa Rinpoche said, "By relating with the ordinary conditions of your life, you might make a shocking discovery. While drinking your cup of tea, you might discover that you are drinking tea in a vacuum. In fact, you are not even drinking the tea, getting the disease. The hollowness of space in drinking the tea is getting the disease. When you put on your makeup, you might discover that you are putting cosmetics on space. You are beautifying space, pure nothingness. When you get cancer or dementia, it is space, pure nothingness, that gets the disease." Doctors, as well as patients and loved ones, succumb to this temptation to pigeonhole and to therefore dismiss. It's easy and convenient. What's being dismissed are the complex factors involved with the disease, the mysterious interplay between physical and spiritual, and the context of a larger spiritual identity. In my practice of dental medicine, the staff will often tell me, "We have a biopsy in operatory 1. We have an abscess in operatory 2. No, we don't. We have a human being, a sacred expression of pure spirit, dealing with a temporary physical hiccup. So when a patient gives me their health history and says, 'I have cancer,' I feel like replying, 'Don't let it have you. Don't let it possess you.' Never forget, as author Stephen Levine says, that we are spiritual beings with physical experiences, not physical beings with spiritual experiences. This is why the teachings of Part 1, our spiritual preparation, come before and contain the considerations presented in Part 2, the practical preparation. While honoring the latter, we should always take refuge in the former. Like space itself, spirit easily contains and remains unaffected by anything that arises within it." Iyengar says, "Though the body is subject to sickness, age, decay, and death, the spirit remains unaffected. Birth and death are natural phenomena, but the soul is not subject to birth and death. As a man casting off worn-out garments takes on new ones, so the dweller within the body, casting aside worn-out bodies, enters into others that are new." Empty the disease. We briefly discussed emptiness earlier, which is one of the most important teachings in Buddhism. A deep understanding of emptiness would completely transform the way we relate to disease and death. Emptiness is the ultimate holding environment. Kenpo Sultrim Gyamso Rinpoche talks about the importance of emptiness in relation to disease. "The reason we have trouble with illness is that we have the wrong view about illness, a mistaken understanding. We cling to it as truly existent, and then it is difficult to heal ourselves. So remember this view. Look directly at the illness. If it did not exist before, how could it possibly exist later? This is another way of saying that the illness has no essence. It is empty of inherent existence. But on the level of apparent reality, it arises as mere appearance, like a dream, an illusion, a reflection of the moon and water. With an understanding that illness is not truly existent, you could cure yourself." Rinpoche's last statement is a challenging one. It is not meant to burden the patient by making them feel that their disease and its cure is due merely to their views about it. This popular New Age notion that we somehow create our disease with our bad thoughts and can cure it with good ones is facile and careless. It puts undue responsibility and stress on the person already suffering from the ailment. The last thing a person suffering from a disease needs to hear is that they somehow created it. There's a place for the power of positive thinking, but there's a higher place for the power of accurate thinking. Buddhism teaches that thought affects physical reality. It doesn't create it. This New Age notion that you create reality can lead to what psychotherapist John Wellwood calls spiritual bypassing, using spiritual ideas or practices to avoid or prematurely transcend relative human needs, feelings, personal issues, and developmental tasks. This bypassing manifests in what Wellwood calls Advaita speaking, where Advaita is the Sanskrit word for non-duality, a state ascribed to God or the Absolute. This heavenly state can't be reached by reason or relativity. Because it's non-dual, it's beyond dualistic and rational criticism. It's above the messiness of being human. It is the untouchable superiority of this view, the dismissive quality of the complexities of relative reality that's so seductive to New Age thinking, and a limitation of it. If non-duality doesn't honor duality, it becomes sterile, disconnected, and dangerous. It becomes a one-sided transcendentalism that uses non-dual terms and ideas to bypass the challenging work of personal transformation. Advaita speak can be very tricky, for it uses absolute truth to disparage relative truth, emptiness to devalue form, and oneness to belittle individuality. In other words, it's a superficial view that engenders an escapist attitude about relative details and difficulties. Understanding spiritual bypassing helps us avoid the other extreme of taking excessive refuge in the spiritual or the absolute. While we do want to identify with the spiritual, exclusive identification with it creates its own set of problems. We can become disembodied, disconnected, elitist, apathetic, even nihilistic. In other words, literally and metaphorically out of touch. In an effort to find heaven on the spiritual path, we lose contact with earth. A complete and accurate identification with the spiritual, in the words of Ken Wilber, transcends but includes the material. It honors and integrates the relative while simultaneously transcending it. Without this more complete view, a well-intentioned but misinformed spiritual person may visit the dying and bring an attitude that doesn't acknowledge the real suffering of sickness and death. An absolute-only view will not connect such a person to relative reality, as temporary as that reality may be. The result can be a disingenuous compassion, a lack of empathy, or an understanding that is patronizing. Once again, if the dying person isn't open to your views, don't force your philosophy upon them. And be careful not to exude an Advaita speak aura. What's the big deal here? Can't you see that none of this is really happening? That everything is empty? While it's important to take refuge in the spiritual, always acknowledge and honor the material. The ultimate view is to unite the two. What Kenpo Rinpoche's statement therefore implies, yet again, is that while acknowledging the relative appearance of the disease, we shouldn't solidify it. If we examine the illusory and transparent quality, not only of the disease, but of the body that temporarily expresses it, this helps to generate the proper holding environment. And while doing this investigation, we should always acknowledge the power of relative truth. Things do appear to be a certain way from a confused perspective, but are not that way from a more realized one. The conclusion of such an analysis would be one of the central tenets of the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Emptiness cannot harm emptiness. A disease empty of inherent existence cannot harm a body empty of inherent existence. An attack in a dream cannot affect a dream body. Emptiness does not deny appearance. It challenges the status and solidity of that appearance. A true understanding of emptiness doesn't slip into spiritual bypassing, because while surpassing material reality, emptiness always respects and embraces it. Emptiness undercuts our propensity to identify with things, which is a central function of ego, even if those things are pathological. We have stressed that the ego is exclusive identification with form. Now we can see that it is exclusive identification with anything.